Okay, everybody, hope you're doing well, enjoying the rain. You know, in Eretz Yisrael, whenever it rains, it normally is a very, very joyous occasion. We don't get rain a lot of the year, and this is the rainy season, so we're very, very grateful. So you should actually dance in the rain and rejoice in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's brachos. In fact, it has been pointed out that one of the important lessons we can give our children is to kind of appreciate life in all of its variations. You know, instead of saying when it's raining, oh, it's raining, and instead of saying when it's hot, oh, it's hot, and when it's cold, oh, it's cold, you can flip everything over in a positive way. Wow, it's great that it's raining. Wow, the sun is so shining today. Wow, it's so nice and cool and bracing. You know, and he says that actually really affects the way a child grows up, because a child grows up and looks at the world in a positive way, and then has emunah in Hashem, and even when things are difficult, they realize that Gamzu L'Tova, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is benevolent and good and kind. So those little things that we do when kids are very young can make a very, very big difference in how an adult perceives life. So rejoice in the rain. Anyway, we are still continuing with our discussion of fertility. And again, if you remember the hypothetical, we actually had a very concrete hypothetical. We have a religious Jewish couple that are going to a hospital in order to have an IVF protocol, in vitro fertilization protocol. And there are a number of options that can be done with what you might call surplus embryos. That means they give the woman a lot of hormonal medication to stimulate ovulation, because they want to maximize the chances of success. So they might take as many as 20 eggs. Now, if one or two get fertilized, then okay, that'll be it. But let's say 20 eggs and 15 of them wind up to be fertilized, right? So one of the big questions that you'll be asked to consider in an agreement is, what should we do with the extra embryos? These are not extra eggs, these are extra embryos. These are fertilized embryos. So we discussed a few possibilities. One is implant them all right now, which may be dangerous. Option number two is freeze some of them for use in a later reproductive cycle, which is actually perfectly good. That actually is a very good option. The fact that they were fertilized at the same time doesn't mean they have to be implanted at the same time. As long as they're implanted, everything is going to be good. Option three is donate the embryos to an infertile couple. So I had mentioned that halakhically is very, very problematical, because we'll see when we discuss egg donation that there's a very, very big machlokas. Who is the mother of a child if the egg comes from one woman and the birth mother is another woman? So the child's not clear who the mother is. Now, if that means if the child's mother is the Jewish woman whose egg was fertilized, then you obviously can't give the child to a Geisha woman or a non-religious woman, because then you'd be taking a Jewish child and raising them, or causing them to be raised non-religiously. But even if it's from religious Jew to religious Jew, in which that's not a problem, still, if you're not clear who the mother is, there's a real, real problem. Which siblings and which relatives would this child be able to marry? Right? So as a result, donation is not the best thing. Now, the last thing we considered at the end is donation of embryos for stem cell research or embryonic research. So that really is, we were in the middle or towards the end of that discussion, which got us into the digression. It's not a digression, but it's really part of the discussion about the permissibility of stem cell research. Now, you'll remember what stem cells are. These are embryonic stem cells. There are other types of stem cells as well. Embryonic stem cells are that when an egg is fertilized and you have what is called a blastocyst, and it just splits for a while. So for the first 10 to 14 days or so, you don't really have differentiated cells. You don't have heart, liver, kidney. You just have cells. They haven't become anything yet. And it was discovered around 20 years ago that if you take those stem cells, which have not yet become identified, they can be indefinitely cultured in a petri dish, and they could eventually be coaxed. Sounds almost like a volitional thing. They could be coaxed to become anything. Heart tissue, spinal cord tissue. They're kind of like the body's repair system. Like they kind of repair things and the like. Eventually, as I think I indicated, stem cells might be used to create whole organs. And that would avoid all the ethical and halakhic problems of brain death and taking organs from people who were killed or whatever it would be, because you could actually create the organ through stem cells and the like. Now, stem cells do exist, and I'm reviewing a little bit, but we'll get on to something new in a few minutes. Stem cells exist in different forms. There is embryonic stem cells, which are the stem cells from the first 10 to 14 days of fertilization. There are also stem cells in bone marrow, and stem cells in umbilical cord and placenta. And these stem cells are already very, very, very useful in treating cancer and the like. And it really is a very, very wonderful type of medical treatment. But the problem with embryonic stem cells is that in order to get embryonic stem cells, you are destroying an embryo. You are destroying a human embryo. So the halakhic problem is this treated as an abortion? Because abortion is a sin. Granted, it's not the same as murder, but abortion is a very serious sin unless the mother's life is in danger. And the question becomes whether the retrieval of embryonic stem cells is considered to be hapalah. Hapalah is just the word for abortion, and would be prohibited. Not that it's any proof, but as you know, the Catholic Church's position, which is very against abortion, also is against stem cell retrieval, because they argue that stem cell retrieval is abortion, because life begins, in their view, as soon as there is what is called conception. Of course, you know the joke that liberals make about pro-lifers, although again, philosophically, we're much closer to pro-lifers than pro-choicers, but the joke they make about pro-lifers, who often don't provide money for taking care of children, they say, life begins at conception and ends at birth. Yeah, that's their joke. That once the kid's born, they don't care. They only care about fetuses. But okay, now, the truth is, Judaism says we have to care about fetuses.
That's what I
Yeah, we have to care about fetuses and care about children at the same time.
Why would you take a stem cell?
Huh? Why would you take a stem cell? Well, because stem cell. Because the following. Let's say. A person has a defect, you know, any person has defective heart valve tissue. So you inject stem cells into the body, and the stem cells gravitate to where, there's almost instinctively, they gravitate to where there's a need, and the stem cells can become heart valve tissue.
So, and that destroys the embryo?
Well, no. What destroys the embryo is, you know, you have an embryo in a petri dish. In order to take stem cells, you destroy the embryo by taking the stem cells. Once you inject them into a patient, the embryo is already destroyed. It's the taking of the stem cells that destroys the embryo, because the stem cells are the embryo. The embryo, for the first 10 to 14 days...
So that's the only reason why you're taking the embryo, is to get stem cells from it?
I'm not following your question. This is the option under discussion. You want to donates an embryo for stem cell retrieval. That's not the only reason, but that is the option we're discussing right now. In other words, we're discussing the issue of what does a couple agree to do with extra embryos beyond those that they want to implant. So one option is they donate the embryos for medical research, where the embryos will be dismembered, so to speak, dismembered in order to provide stem cells. Right? So we're discussing, is that halachically permitted? Now, stem cells can help many, many sick people, right? So can I give an embryo, fertilized embryo, to a clinic or to a hospital to be able to retrieve stem cells and thereby help patients, right? That's going to be the question. Now, again, let me just make the following point that you need to take this in perspective. The size of an embryo at 10 days is around, it's not invisible, but it is the size of a pencil point. Take your pencil and make a big of a thick point. It's not a tiny point, make a thick point. And that is how big it is. And you're taking cells from that point. The Catholic Church says that is murder. I'm just giving you the perspective, because that is a human being at this point. Now, what would Jewish law say? Because if Jewish law would treat stem cell retrieval as murder, then obviously you wouldn't be allowed to do it. So we had mentioned two halachic arguments that might permit the use of embryos for stem cell retrieval, even though you're destroying the embryo. Halachic argument number one is the shita means the view, of some poskim, that any abortion is permitted, even in the woman's body, if it is within 40 days of conception. There is such a principle, based on a teaching in the Gemara, that any embryo less than 40 days old is treated as mere water, it's not yet developed sufficiently, to be treated as a human being. Now, it's very clear that an embryo from which you are getting stem cells is much less than 40 days. In fact, as I indicated, you'll get it within 10 to 14 days. So if you follow the poskim that say that all abortion is permitted within 40 days of conception, then stem cell retrieval would certainly be permitted, which would mean, in other words, you would be allowed to donate your surplus embryos to science for stem cell retrieval, because it's less than 40 days. Okay, so if you follow that view, for sure it's going to be permitted. This would also justify, as an aside, the so-called morning after pill, which prevents a fertilized embryo from being implanted or dislodges it if it is implanted, even though one might argue it is an abortion, not a contraceptive, because it is already destroying a fertilized embryo. But obviously it's the morning after, so it's within 40 days. So in that sense, it might be permitted. Now, that is a line of halachic reasoning. Let me point out, however, that contrary to what people think, because you see people always say, oh, halakha permits abortion within 40 days. Like, everybody always says that.
When it suits them.
Yeah, that is far from universally the case. Many, 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 many great rabbis say that Jewish law does prohibit abortion even within 40 days. Among them, the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself, the Rebbe said this, Rav Moshe Feinstein, many other great rabbis as well. And if we are lenient sometimes on the 40 days, perhaps it'll be in extreme cases like rape or incest. So even though we don't permit abortion for rape and incest as a matter of course, but sometimes you'll see in the case of pre-40 days, we might be lenient because of the trauma of rape or incest. But it is absolutely not the case that most rabbis will indiscriminately permit abortion within 40 days. Some will.
Because here it says the reason behind it being allowed pre-40 days is that it's considered kind of as water.
The counter argument, which is actually a very, very strong argument, is that the context in which the Talmud says it is mere water is not referring to abortion at all. It is referring to what types of miscarriages necessitate a sacrifice in the temple. for childbirth. Remember, a woman who miscarries has to bring a sacrifice in the temple, and the Talmud says if it was a very, very early miscarriage, in fact, commonly a woman might not even know it was a miscarriage, she does not have to bring a korban because it is mere water. However, their argument is that that refers to what is sufficient for a korban, and that is not transferable to the abortion context.
When you mean sufficient for a korban, is that if they are...
Meaning in order to bring a korban, there has to be a miscarriage of a substantial fetus.
Right.
And less than 40 days is not yet substantial enough for a korban purpose, but the sanctity of life would still mean we're not allowed to destroy it unless the mother's life is in danger. Yeah.
I have a sad question, and no one should know such thing, but how late into the pregnancy would you have to have a funeral for a fetus?
Well, the general rule is, that's a little complicated, because generally speaking, for any stillbirth, there's no need for a funeral.
Oh, really?
In fact, even if a baby is born alive and dies, if a baby dies within 30 days of birth, there does not have to be a funeral. So a funeral is a different set of halachos.
Like burying the...
Yes, a fetus does not have to be buried. Now, you know, commonly we will do it for respect, but a fetus that is stillborn, even at nine months, does not have to be buried. Only a live birth has to be buried. So that's a different...
After 30 days.
Say again?
After 30 days.
No. A live birth is buried right away, but you don't observe mourning till after 30 days. There are different levels. One is burial, one is morshin and shiva.
Yeah.
So that's a different type of question, a different type of problem. By the way, there's an important, again, I mean, God forbid, no one should ever know any miscarriages of any way. But, you know, it's important for a woman to keep a record of her miscarriages, because it is highly, highly relevant for pidyon haben. Now, what is pidyon haben? Pidyon haben is redemption of the firstborn. Now, if a woman's firstborn child is a boy, and it was a vaginal delivery, not a cesarean, right? So on the 30th day of birth, one has to redeem the firstborn son by giving money to the cult, giving 5 shekel. It's not Israeli shekel, but 5 biblical shekel, which is much more money, to the Kohen. Now, the rule is that if a woman had a miscarriage and the baby had developed until a certain point, that is called a prior birth, and she does not do a pidyon haben for the live birth afterwards. If it's a very early miscarriage, then the halacha is it doesn't count, and the next one will have a pidyon haben. So the dividing line might be 40 days. I say might be because it's a little complicated, meaning any early discharge, again, commonly a woman might not even know, but any discharge less than 40 days from conception has no effect on whether the next birth it has a pidyon haben. By the way, let me tell you a very interesting shaila, which is not our topic at all tonight, but it's very, very fascinating. This is a tshuva, a responsum from Rav Avadya Yosef. And listen to this very fascinating question. A woman was a balat tshuva. She was a, she became a religious woman, and she came from a background that was not so tznius. And she actually, in her years of not being religious, she actually got pregnant, and she had an abortion. She became a very religious woman. She married a very religious man, and she had been advised not to tell the man about her history.
Oh.
Okay. So far so good.
I mean,
that's a matter of other discussion that we can get into. But then she got pregnant with their first child.
And it was a problem.
So the man is so happy, we're gonna have a son, and there's gonna be a Brit and a pidyon haben, and she was praying, let it be a girl, let it be a girl. Of course, I'm not saying God forbid, the only reason to have a girl is to avoid pidyon haben problems, but whatever it is. God forbid. But he was really hoping for a son. And what happened was, I guess his prayers were stronger. They got a son. Now, here's the problem. If she had an abortion and the fetus had already developed, then the halacha is there is no pidyon haben. And if you recite the blessing, now, of course, you can give money to a Kohen anytime you want, but if you recite all the blessings, it's a blessing in vain, and you're committing a very, very serious aveira. So Rav Adya was asked a question. I'm not sure how it came up through him confidentially. Obviously, if the husband would have known, that would have ruined the whole thing. But Rav Adya basically said, what is the woman to do? Does she have to tell her husband, we're not supposed to have a pigeon aban because I had a miscarriage, an abortion? Even if she doesn't say, okay, maybe she does. Now, the truth is, she doesn't have to say it was an abortion. She could say it was a miscarriage, but she still would be saying she had a pregnancy before marriage, even if she can sugarcoat it, and she doesn't have to say it was an abortion. That much she doesn't have to say. So you know what he paskins? He paskins that because revealing this information would, number one, cause her great embarrassment and would undermine the shalom bayit, the peace with her husband, it is permissible to allow a blessing in vain to be made.
Wow.
In order not to cause embarrassment, humiliation, and lack of shalom bayit.
Yeah.
And therefore he said, don't tell the husband and do the pigeon aban. Now, he did say the best thing to do would be, if you could, well, it depends on the circumstances. If you could tell your husband that, if you've been married long enough that perhaps you could say you had an early miscarriage, you know, in the marriage that you didn't tell him about, something like that. Or you could say, hey, I discovered my mother was from a Levi, you know, because pigeon aban is unusual, because not only if the woman's father is a Kohen or a Levi, there's no pigeon aban, but even if the woman's mother is from a Kohen or a Levi. So if she could say some type of, make up some family history, of course that's going to be difficult if her parents
are
there.
It's getting a bit messy.
Right? it's getting messy.
I feel guilty.
How does the say? Well, yeah, but Rav Adya said, this is the halacha. There is a principle. Now, don't generalize this to all things, but there is a principle that sometimes, and I say sometimes because it is a complicated principle, kavod habrios, that means human dignity, respect to prevent embarrassment, can override some prohibitions, especially shalom bayit. Remember, remember the ritual of the woman suspected of adultery, the sota. So the way a woman clears herself if she was accused of being with a man is psukim of the Torah, which have Hashem's name on them, are written and they're dissolved in the water in the time of the temple, and she drinks this water, and if she's guilty of adultery, she dies a horrible death right away. But if she's innocent, she's cleared and she's even blessed. And the Talmud says, God says, it is better that my name be erased in the water in order to make shalom between a husband and a wife. So there is this concept that shalom bayis is that important. It's a very, very fascinating thing. But again, as I say, these are difficult Shilos, I mean, I'll give you another example. I don't know why I'm thinking of racy Shilos tonight. But this was a famous responsum of the Noda Yehuda, Rav Yecheskel Lando, who was the great Rav of Prague, one of the great poskim 200 years ago. And his Shilos was the following. A young man who was a yeshiva student, who was supported by his in-laws and was living in his in-laws' house, had a long-term affair with his mother-in-law. The problem is this. If a woman commits voluntary adultery, I don't mean God forbid rape, if a woman commits adultery, she is not allowed to stay with her husband. So the question becomes, must the son-in-law tell his father-in-law that he has had an affair with his mother-in-law?
No way.
Which would actually, because after all, if he doesn't, his father-in-law is guilty of the sin of being with an adulterous wife.
Even if he doesn't know?
Yeah, well, it's an accidental sin. It's like eating treif. If I know you're eating treif, I have to tell you. So the question is, isn't this like eating treif? My father-in-law is eating treif. Every moment he's with his wife, am I obligated?
Or is there a concept
of kavod habriyah? Now, the Noda Yehuda himself happens to be very, very strict. He says, "Yep, gotta go." Although he says, "You don't have to say
it was you."
I think it's a little cowardly. He says, "You don't have to say you were the one. You can just say that you know." I always thought that's kind of unfair because she's the one that's really in trouble. But other rabbis, other poskim today actually say you're not obligated to, you know, and even a woman herself. If a woman had an affair, and a woman's a religious woman, and now she's doing tshuva, she had an affair, the poskim do say she is not obligated.
I just feel like that's too easy. If she had a voluntary like relationship, like an affair outside of the marriage, I was like, oh well, you know, I kind of didn't have to say it. Oh well, tough, you know.
But you understand.
How much she should have thought of that before?
No, but you understand the difficulty. This is not simply I just want to point out that, again, you understand the difficulty here. It's not simply a question of coming clean and being honest. The problem is the marriage would have to end halakhically, and that's a very serious issue. It's not, if it would simply be a matter...
They are not allowed to work through it.
That's what I'm saying. Meaning to say, reconciliation is not permitted for voluntary adultery. That's where we get...
On
her part. That's where we get the problem.
What about on his part?
He can have multiple wives.
Yeah. If a man, you understand this. This is no. The halacha is very clear. Again, I'm not going to be able to fully explain it to you, but the halacha is very, very clear that if a married man has affairs with single women, unmarried women. Although it's a very, very disgusting thing. It's a very disgusting thing. No, absolutely. Absolutely it's a disgusting thing. He is halakhically disgusting. But halakhically, if his wife is willing to forgive him, they are permitted to stay married. If on the other, I don't know, if she wants to forgive him, if she wants to get, she can go to basement and demand to get. Yeah, that's true.
No, but why not both ways?
But the halakha is, if a woman voluntarily committed adultery,
women are smarter.
And the man wants to forgive her, in many cases he cannot, because the Torah, she's like a treif, she's forbidden to him at this point. Well, it goes back to the idea that the Torah permits polygamy, so a man is permitted halakhically to have multiple relationships, a woman is not. A woman, in many ways, what can you say? Jews are held to a higher standard. Women are held to a higher standard. There's the superior.
Really?
The superior being is always held.
Well,
why? Jews are held.
Guys, 2 minutes ago, we just said that nowadays they pass him that a woman doesn't have to tell her husband if she's doing tshuva, and we all were up in arms about that. So, people are coming around to help women out.
Yep. Okay, so again, the bottom line is, Taka, that if a woman has an affair, neither her paramour nor she needs to tell the husband, and that's what the poskim do say. Now, I understand the dilemma you're describing, because it's a tremendous weight on a person, meaning when a person really wants reconciliation, they want to be able to be open, to be honest, and work through the issues. In fact, there are therapists who specialize in trying to repair marriages after infidelity. It's actually a branch of marriage, it's a specialty within marital therapy, because it's a very, very delicate process. And one of the problems we have is, well, can such a process work within Judaism? Meaning, is the only, I sympathize with the problem, is the only option we give the woman just keep quiet about it? Now, at least that's an option. The Nevi Yehuda didn't even give her that option. At least we give the woman the option of keeping quiet.
She's allowed to not tell him.
That's what I'm telling you. But what I'm saying is, where you have a problem is, that's what I'm saying.
Then he'll be doing.
No. So I'm saying, so the poskim basically say that because of kavod abrios, you don't have to tell him, even though he's doing an aveira. But the problem is, once you tell him, we do have that problem. Once he knows, you do have a problem, and. The psychological issue here is that you're not creating a mechanism where, as a couple, they're able to work it out together, and that is a real problem. Now, there is a view that says she can tell him, and he's allowed to stay with her if he says he doesn't believe her, because after all, she's not two witnesses, right? Now, that creates its own problem, because that basically says, we can stay married if I don't believe you, and you're just fantasizing. How are you going to
work through it?
So, okay, you're not going to like this either. There is this psychological double process in which, I don't believe you, but I believe that you had an affair.
Yeah, heard that.
And therefore, I will help you based on the feelings that you have even though I don't believe it actually happened.
Can he just say that, or does he actually have to believe that?
So the that's a good question. The post can basically say that if he considers his wife to be a completely reliable person, then he won't be able to go through this motion. But if sometimes he thinks his wife makes up stories. But now, again, I just want to tell you that as a rabbi, you know, this is real difficult because once again, it basically says, we can stay married if I look at you as a hallucinating nut. You know, that's not so great either.
Why is this the way it is? This doesn't seem...
No.
Starting from a place of the marriage...
Again, we have the halakha. It's based on the halakha. It is based on the halakha. The halakha is a fixed halakha. A woman who commits voluntary, not God forbid rape or anything, voluntary adultery, cannot stay married to her husband.
What is voluntary? That's where you can ask the question.
Well, you can talk about that. You're right, but obviously, some cases are easy. If she was raped, if she did it under gunpoint or knife or threat, that's not voluntary.
But hold on.
Yeah.
But like, how can it be that the halacha then can kind of, you know, has a little bit of leniency depending on embarrassment, all this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Can't you do that with a lot of halachot? Like, for example, if you have someone, let's say, who, I don't know, whose dad is Jewish but whose mom isn't Jewish, but he went to a Jewish school, all this kind of stuff, to avoid the embarrassment he doesn't have.
No, I understand. I understand. I didn't get into all the qualifications. Let me just say that in most cases, you cannot transgress a biblical Torah law just to protect human dignity. In a lot of the cases...
Adultery.
Yeah, I understand. But here's the problem. But here's the problem. To establish adultery under Torah law, you'd have to have two witnesses. That's the issue. In other words, a lot of what you're dealing with here are the rules of evidence. The rules of evidence in halacha are very strict. And technically, they might require two eyewitnesses who see them going into a hotel room. Or something.
Two of them as well?
Yeah, two of them. So as a result, a lot of the manipulation we have here, even though adultery is a Torah law, is that you don't have the biblical quantum of evidence, and that gives us leeway to be mako. But on a pure Torah law, like, you know, driving on Shabbos or something like that, you can't use human dignity as a heter for that.
Although, what about ripping toilet paper? I heard that if you're in a place...
So the answer is exactly that. You have to rip it with your elbow.
Like in a weird...
And therefore, by doing the malacha in a shinoi, you've made it rabbinic. And rabbinic prohibitions are waived for human dignity. You can't rip it. In a Torah way. That's exactly right. In other words, that proves the point I just made, that you normally cannot violate Torah laws.
Does that kind of qualify as well? If, let's say, you're staying somewhere and they turn off the lights in the bathroom, can you do it with, like, your elbow as well?
It depends on the scenario. I understand that, but that depends on the scenario. If without the light, you're going to miss your targets or whatever it is, then perhaps that's so. But if it's simply inconvenient for you, inconvenience is not the same as human dignity, so you couldn't...
No, for sure.
Yeah, but if it's really a situation you wouldn't know where to go, then that would be a similar idea. Just be sure you don't overgeneralize. Meaning, human dignity means it will be a severe humiliation.
No. I'm not talking about...
Yeah, we're not talking about, I'd rather have the light on because I want to read a magazine in the bathroom. You know.
No. I'm talking like along the same lines as tearing the toilet paper. That's okay. That's like...
Well, okay. That is.
Yeah.
Now, in the time of the Talmud, they used to use the stones, but okay. We improve things a little bit. Okay. Alrighty.
If he's a Kohen and she's raped, Chas v'Shalom, does she have to tell him?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that one. Because when I said before...
No.
I know, this is really a hard night.
If she's a Kohen?
She cannot tell him?
Let me just explain the problem again. When you're dealing with a regular non-Kohen person, so the wife is forbidden only when there was voluntary adultery, and if there's rape, it's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine, meaning it's not fine, but they're allowed to stay married. They can work it through, and the like. The problem is a Kohen is extra, extra strict. Mm-hmm. And a Kohen, even if, God forbid, there is a rape, a Kohen is not allowed to stay married. But I want to point out there too, we do apply the
is
halachic.
That even
before? No. Only after they were married. After they were married.
So, like, if someone.
If a woman was raped,
so before they were married. Still a problem.
Okay.
It's not a virgin.
Okay. Let me just give you the rule about a Kohen very straight. A woman does not have to be a virgin to marry a Kohen.
What?
A woman can marry a Kohen even if she's not a virgin, but not if she had relations with a non-Jew. So if a woman, before she was married, was either raped by a non-Jew or had consensual intercourse with a non-Jew, she cannot marry a Kohen. If, however, she either consensually was with a Jew or was, God forbid, raped by a Jew, she is allowed to marry a Kohen. She does not have to be a virgin per se. Now, once she is married to a Kohen, the halacha gets one step stricter, that whether she is raped or consensual with a Jew or with a non-Jew, she cannot stay married to her husband.
Why?
These are standards of a Kohen, because a Kohen.
What if he has an affair?
It doesn't affect male.
Take another wedding.
Yeah. Now the question is.
Get divorced and then remarry.
Well, Cohen can't marry a divorced woman.
She's
so that's not going to work. This is why, by the way, this is why there is what is called within the shidduch crisis, which is an overall shidduch. No, it's called the shidduch crisis. There is a shidduch crisis, of which all of you are part of a crisis. You are a crisis.
Sure.
But so within,
you're safe. You're safe. You got
the flag. It should be for all of you. By the way, have you come across Rabbi Manus Friedman from? So he has a boot camp for girls. For he has one for boys, one for girls, one for men, one for women.
A bunch of boys.
About shiduchim. So it's very, very good talk. He ends with it's on YouTube. But he ends with a very strong message of comfort. Your husband is waiting for you. He just has to sort through all the other people till he gets to you.
That is not comforting.
No. He is there.
He's in line. Don't worry.
No. He's there, and he's going to
he's
find you.
He's looking for you.
Okay. Yeah. But be it as it may, so one of the subcategories of the shidduch crisis is kohanim, male kohanim, who are older, let's say they're in their 30s, late 20s or 30s.
It's not that old.
Not that old, I understand, but they're not. But you see, there's a problem because if they're balei tshuva, they're likely to date, you know, women who have from a similar background. And above a certain age, many women are not... They might have been with people, and if they were with non-Jews, there's a real halachic problem of marrying a Kohen. But I do want to tell you, if they were with Jews, there is no disqualification at all. You do not have to be a virgin to marry a Kohen.
What about a Kohen who is a widow and he's in his 70s? He wouldn't really be able to get remarried.
Why not? He can marry a widow.
Oh, he can marry a widow.
Yeah. Remember, I think, what you're mixing up is you're mixing up the special rules of Kohen Gadol, which we don't have today, with a regular Kohen. A regular Kohen can marry a widow perfectly fine. It is only the Kohen Gadol who cannot marry a widow. And a regular Kohen can marry a non-virgin as long as she was not with a goy.
And not divorced, though.
But not divorced, right? He cannot marry a divorced person, yeah.
So I have two friends who are Kohanim and also like single and 35, 36.
Boy or girl?
What?
Boys.
Yes. Yeah.
And one is struggling with that, and he asked a very lenient rabbi.
Yeah.
Who said that it was okay to apply the policy, don't ask. Don't tell.
Well, again, let me point out that there is a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein. I may have told you the story before, but let me tell you the tshuva that says, if a man knows or thinks he's a Kohen only because he heard it from relatives like his parents, who themselves are not Shabbos observant. Mm-hmm. They are not kosher witnesses. And he is allowed to assume that he's not a Kohen because there's no proof. See, proof is a very important element in this issue. What's the proof? And the proof standards might be very, very strong. So I'll give you an example. That doesn't mean anything at all.
Yeah,
because when a lot of European immigrants came to Ellis Island, they just gave him the name Cohen, because Cohen, they thought the Irish, they thought that's a Jewish name. You know the story. You know the story about Sean Ferguson. It's a famous old joke. It's like a vaudeville joke about there was a Hasidic Yid who was applying for a driver's license, and the guy asked him, "What's his name?" He says, "Sean Ferguson." So, Sean Ferguson. What type of name is that? So he shows him. You know, I came from Poland last year, and they put on my card Sean Ferguson. So, how did they put Sean Ferguson? Well, it says, my name was Simcha Goldwasser, and when they asked me how to spell it, I said, Schein Vergessen. I've already forgotten in Yiddish, Schein Vergessen. Sean Ferguson. Okay. So, names don't mean anything at all. In fact, there are many, many Cohens who are actually not Cohens at all, and the like. So, I'll tell you the case that I was involved in a little, not involved, but I actually know the people. They're very, very good friends of my wife and of me as well. And this was a man who thought he was a Kohen, but he grew up as secular. He married a non-Jew, not a convert. He married a non-Jewish woman. He had four children from this non-Jewish woman, totally non-religious life. And she became inspired to look into Judaism. And she eventually wanted to keep mitzvos and become frum, and she wanted to convert. Now, the problem is, of course, there's a tremendous problem here, because yet another woman a Kohen cannot marry. A Kohen can't marry a divorced woman. A Kohen cannot marry a convert to Judaism. So here's the problem. There's a catch-22 here. In order for a woman to convert to Judaism, for anyone to convert to Judaism, they have to accept the 613 commandments of the Torah. One of the commandments was a Kohen cannot live with a converted woman. So, now of course, a Kohen can't live with the guy either, but that's a sin, but that's before her conversion. But if they convert her, she has to agree. So, the basement in Chicago was aware of this question, and they said, we're going to ask higher authority, we're not going to tell you, but you have to be aware that there's at least a possibility that in order to convert you, you'd have to leave your husband. So they called her in separately, and they asked her separately, is your desire to become Jewish so powerful that you would be willing to leave your husband if that became necessary? She broke down crying, and she said, if this is the will of Hashem, says, I accept it, as devastating as it is. They then called in her husband, who was not religious really, and they said, you know, we can convert your wife, but do you realize you may have to be separated? So he said, you rabbis are nuts, and he just walked out on them. But anyway, he was not converting. She was the one. So they went to Reb Moshe Feinstein, who was the greatest halachic decisor, and he said, this is his ruling, that if the only way he knows he's a Kohen is from his parents, who themselves were not Shomer Shabbos, he does not have to assume that he is a Kohen, and therefore he is allowed to stay married to his wife. And they, but he's not a Kohen. He can't be both. He can't be a Kohen and stay married. But he's allowed.
He's not religious.
Well, he became religious, but when he be, now what's strange was his father, who was not religious, but when he would visit, he would still exercise the prerogatives of a Kohen, get the first Aliyah, the Torah, etc. But the son did not. The son did not behave like a Kohen. Now the son tells me that he is very scared when Mashiach comes. Because when Mashiach comes, maybe he'll discover he's a Kohen. And then he won't be able to stay married with his wife.
Isn't he just not a Kohen anymore? Does he lose his status?
Well, you don't really lose your status. It's just because if you are a Kohen, you are a Kohen. The only thing is you're allowed to assume. He's allowed to assume he's not a Kohen. But theoretically, he might be a Kohen. So the truth of the matter is that we have to assume that somehow Hashem will not allow Rav Moshe to make a mistake of that nature. things will work out. Maybe he'll discover his wife was really Jewish. That happens too. There are women, or people, not just women, people who convert, who discover after their conversion that their great-grandmother on their mother's side was actually Jewish. So there are converts who are not converts. They were born Jews for that way. So things work out in this way. So this is a very, very complicated area. And as I say, the rules of evidence are very, very critical, whether it's adultery, whether it's rape, whether it's conversion, married to a Kohen. Because even if we have the halacha, but the halachic rules may require a certain level of evidence. And until you have that evidence, the prohibition is not going to come in. So that's why you need really almost a specialist rabbi for these things. The average rabbi might not be able to go through the nitty-gritty of these particular problems. Okay. Alrighty. How did I get onto this? I have no idea. This was a long digression. Tavod Abriya, 1 second. Okay, we were talking about the 40-day abortion. Okay, that's right. Okay. Now, the second argument we mentioned, again, we're talking about stem cell retrieval, killing the embryo to get the stem cells, was the idea, okay, let's say it is an abortion, but if you can do it to save the mother's life, why can't I do it to save Christopher Reeve's life or whatever it is? Meaning to say, one could make the argument that whatever you want to call stem cell retrieval, it has the potential to save people's lives, so let it be mutar, because of pikuach nefesh, even abortion is permitted. Mamish abortion is permitted to save the mother's life, so maybe I could kill the embryo to save somebody's life. So the reason why this may not be a good argument is there are two reasons. Number one, at most this would be a heter if the stem cells are directly going into a patient who might otherwise die, like a person with defective heart valve, etc. But a lot of stem cell retrieval is used for research. It is not used in direct therapy. If it's not used in direct therapy, the heter of saving a life does not apply. Saving a life applies when what you're doing is going to directly save a life, not when it's general medical research. That's why, for example, you can't give your body to science. Let's say even a dead body. Forget about abortion. You cannot donate a dead body for scientific dissection, even though we might be getting information that might help us save people in the long run. But if it's not going directly for that purpose, it becomes like a fishing expedition, and that would not be permitted. Okay. But there's a... Yeah.
Can't you get some things like your corneas or your skin?
No, only for... Now again, see the difference here. If you're giving your corneas or skin for an actual patient, the answer is yes. Okay. But you cannot give it for general medical research.
But only external organs?
No, you can give any. Actually, the truth of the matter is, I mean, putting aside the Jew versus Goy problem, because there, I don't want to get into that right now. We talked about it. As a general rule, you can actually donate even internal organs to save a life. But save a life means it directly goes into a patient. It is not just dissected for medical research.
Okay, so they do that here in Israel if there's, like, God forbid, an accident or something.
Well, yes, but in Israel it's more. You know, again, we had three classes in this.
I'll show her my notes.
Okay, show her notes. Yeah, I think it's also on the cloud. I think it might even be taken. Yeah.
Where would the med schools in Israel get cadavers?
Well, number one, the med schools in Israel are not necessarily observant, so they get cadavers the way everyone else gets cadavers. But if you'd be asking me if there would be a halachic med school, where would they get cadavers? They would not use cadavers.
They would be at a huge disadvantage.
Well, you'd be very surprised. There actually is a movement. It's a small movement in the medical general community to use 3D computer generated slides.
And they say, 3D printing.
Yeah,
can't dissect that.
Well, they have ways 3D printing. They have ways of actually doing it. It's neater. I don't know. I don't know why it would be superior to human body, because it seems to me that an actual body is superior.
Yeah.
But they say it's less messy or whatever it is.
Easy to clean up.
You don't have to clean up after. No, but there is a movement. I can look into why it's so. That they're trying to, maybe because there's a shortage of cadavers or whatever it is, they're trying to look at alternatives.
Jews are keeping their bodies.
Just like flight schools, right? You know, Today you largely get flight lessons by flight simulators, very good simulators.
Yeah.
Of course, that's always the thing, without being too macabre, you know.
Don't think about it too much.
In the 9/11, suicide pilots.
They learned. Yeah.
So they took flying lessons, but they didn't take any courses in landing. That should have been a little suspicious. They said they wanted to skip the landing elective.
It sounds
like Saturday Night Live. I mean, it sounds like, you know, such a bizarre thing. But they said they only wanted to take a course in flying. They didn't have to take the landing course.
Surely you'd be suspicious of that.
I would think so.
And driving instructor. Don't worry about the stopping. I just want to know
how to. Yeah, like, just forget about the brakes, right?
Yeah,
right,
take them out. We don't need them.
It's very, very bizarre that they took flying lessons without taking landing lessons. But okay. All right.
I think it's very bizarre they took flying lessons altogether.
Yeah.
That's quite a budget they have there.
Yeah, right. Well, that's plenty of money. Okay. Yeah. Now, so that's one issue, the therapy versus research. But there's a more important issue. And again, some of this is repetitive, but I think we're amplifying it as we're going through. That is, I just want to remind you of the very, very significant argument, Rashi and the Rambam.
Right.
Rashi and the Rambam about why can I abort to save the mother's life? Why is mother better than fetus? Rashi says, fetus is only potential life. Mother is actual life. Actual beats out potential. That's Rashi. Actual beats out potential. Rambam says differently. Mother and fetus are both equal. But the reason mother beats out fetus is when fetus is endangering mother, fetus is called rodef. Do you see the conceptual difference here? According to Rashi, the heter is a hierarchical ranking of mother's life over baby's life. According to the Rambam, it is not a hierarchical ranking idea. It's the idea of rodef. Even though the baby is not malevolent, the baby does not intend to kill the mother, but baby is rodef. Now, rodef means he who is chasing after somebody to kill them. If somebody is trying to kill me, I, or even a third party, is permitted to kill them in self-defense or defense of others.
Is this Ramban or Rambam?
No, Rambam, Maimonides. Now, Maimonides' chidush means his new thought, is that rodef doesn't have to be a bad, evil guy, like a suicide bomber or a terrorist.
Okay.
Rodef can be a little baby, that if the pregnancy or the childbirth is endangering the mother's life, and giving birth to this baby alive is going to kill the mother, you can actually look at the baby as a rodef.
Or it's like the little two-year-old with a gun.
Two-year-old with a gun, exactly right. Mm-hmm. Or if you remember, like the baby that is crying, the Jews are hiding in the bunker, mm-hmm. and the Nazis are searching for Jews, and the baby's crying is going to give away the whereabouts of 10 Jews, according to halacha, as difficult as this sounds, you would be allowed to kill the baby.
You'd be allowed to, or supposed to?
Well, actually, you're supposed to. You're supposed to kill the baby in order that 10 people shouldn't die. In a way, that case is a little easier because the baby would die with the 10. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
But I thought that we didn't have the permission to do that. Like, apparently there was like another case somewhere that
trolley.
It was like. The what?
The
if,
trolley?
If an
army comes to a city.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Yes, but remember the difference. Remember,
they elect one individual person.
That's correct.
No, they volunteer.
If they just say,
you choose
if
one.
They, right, if they say, but, you choose somebody,
yeah, exactly.
you can't make the choice. But here, we know who's endangering. See, in other words,
but
when they...
you're still kind of making the choice.
You're not making a choice.
No.
Maybe he's a rodef.
He's a rodef.
Okay.
I mean, another example. A lifeboat is another example. Let's say you have you're jumping off the Titanic on a lifeboat. And the lifeboat can only hold 10 people.
Push
and
the other.
If there's an 11th person, the boat is going to break or capsize.
So whoever tries to get on, you can push.
So if we knew, let's say there are 11 people on the boat is about to shatter. If we, now here's very important, if we know who the 11th person is, we can throw him overboard.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't know, again, I mean, people may not have the presence of mind to follow halacha here, but if we don't know, I don't have the right to throw you overboard because
you don't know.
You could say to me, who says I'm the rodef? You're the rodef. In other words, it's true that any one is a rodef to the other ten. But there's no way of defining who the rodef is. So, now, a person could volunteer. A person could altruistically volunteer. But nobody could be forced. And in that case, paradoxically, you would have to let, again, this sounds counterintuitive, you would have to let 11 people die instead of killing one. Then you wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
But when you know who the 11th guy is,
we know it's you.
Right? We throw him up. And by the way, fortunately, it doesn't make a difference who's the heavier one. Because even if the heavy guy, as long as the heavy guy is in the first 10, if the ship is not going to break, then he is not a rodef. You can't say, hey, you know, you're taking up two people. That's not a cheshbon. Because if he got on the ship, on the boat, and whatever his weight is, if it wasn't going
to
break,
he just has to sit in the middle, whatever happens.
Right. Then it's the last guy. It is the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. That is the rodef. So all the
it's first come, first served.
That's correct. That's 100% correct. Yeah.
Question: if it says the maximum is 10,
yep.
11th person comes on,
yep.
It's fine. 12th person comes on, then.
Again, I mean, 10 was just a precaution. They just put 10. You told me 11 is safe. So,
you don't have to follow them.
Yeah, the sign is not so magical. Meaning to say,
no, but I'm saying,
whatever number of people can stay on the boat without the boat breaking is not a rodef. The rodef is the last one that is causing the boat to break. That's the rodef. Meaning, whatever the number is, if it's 20 people on the boat. Now, you know, the Titanic, there was a big, big scandal because there were some wealthy people who took their pets on board the lifeboats and they prevented their human beings from going on. Yeah, there was some famous...
You not watched it?
Yeah, they're not... This is historically... No, this is historically the case. It's not just from the movie. This was the actual case that a wealthy woman bribed one of the sailors to let her take her some dogs on and... You know, she said her dog is worth more than whatever. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So this is a very important conceptual machlokes, Rashi and the Rambam. Does mother's life have priority because actual versus potential? Or because baby is rodef? Now, in terms of aborting to save the mother, both will come out to the same way. But destroying an embryo for stem cell research, this would depend on this machlokas. Because if I say actual beats potential, then yeah, Chris Reeve will beat the embryo, and then you'd be allowed to. But if the conceptual justification of this early term abortion is rodef, well, you can't really say that the petri dish with the embryo here is a rodef of the person with heart valve defect there. So then you wouldn't be allowed, right? So that svara, that line of reasoning would not work. And I should say that the Shulchan Aruch, the definitive code of Jewish law, does articulate the abortion heter in the Rambam's language, that it's a din of rodef and not a din in hierarchical ranking. So that would not be a heter of stem cell research, even if it's directly therapeutic, even if it's going into a patient directly.
Rambam.
Yep, that's correct. By the way, let me just mention something about this rule about abortion, that the mother's life takes priority for whatever the reason. Let me point out that here halacha is also clear that although the mother's life takes priority, the mother has the right to make the decision the other way. And this happens. These are tragic situations. But sometimes a mother might say, in fact, one might imagine it would be almost a common response in these uncommon situations. That, I mean, because usually what happens is the woman is, you know, is going to die shortly anyway. In other words, in order to have a birth that's going to kill her, usually the situation is she's already very, very weak. And so she says, instead of my living another 6 months after the abortion, I would rather die to give the baby the life. So according to halacha, although the mother's life does have priority, absolutely, mother has priority, she does have the choice to say, I want to bring this child into the world, even if it will kill her. Now, where things get very, very murky, and I'll give you an actual shaila, is, okay, if the mother is awake and competent, so essentially it's her choice. She could say, abort, because I want to live. Or she could say, I want my husband, I want my family to have a child. I am willing to die. Again, it's very, very sad, but okay. But here's a case. Woman is in a coma. Pregnant woman is in a coma. She's in a coma, right? Huh? No. Here's the question. The question becomes this. The question is, if the baby is delivered, the trauma of the birth might kill her. And it's not always the case, but this is the actual case, that it will kill her. Now here, the halacha clearly says that even if the woman's on life support, her life has priority over the baby, unless she would make a choice. But here's the question. But if she's not able to make a choice,
Does her husband get
to make that choice? Can the husband make a choice based on what his wife... Well, again, it's tricky. And if he could make a choice, is it based on what he wants?
Does it matter?
Well, it does matter. Because technically it's not his decision. I mean, the decision would be, what would my wife want if she could be conscious for 2 seconds? And be aware of her situation. See, it's a difficult mental operation. You're not asking, you know, what is better for me? Let's say if I'm the husband, what's better for me? We're asking, what would my wife want if she would be aware of the situation? Would she prefer to abort the baby and be on life support for another 6 months? Or would she prefer to have the baby and die right now? Now, it might be very logical that most women, if that is the stark dilemma that they're presented with, meaning to say, have the baby and die now, or stay in a coma for another 6 months and die, it may seem logical that
it's nice. Like, even if you're not in a coma, like living with that for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I've killed my child.
So these are very, very difficult. I mean, either way, it's a difficult situation. Even when she's awake and she makes the decision,
right,
it's very difficult.
So, yeah.
But when you're dealing with an unconscious woman in a coma, it becomes a much more difficult problem. The only definite thing I can tell you is, the issue is not what does the husband personally want. The issue is, he has to try to reconstruct what would his wife want if miraculously she would have, you know, 5 seconds to be aware of her situation and be able to say what she wants. We have to try to figure out what it is that she wants. Same thing, I'll give you examples where it's very difficult sometimes. We confuse what we want with what we're supposed to think the other person wants. You know, every year, I'll give you an analogy from a totally different area. Every year, people will kill a spouse that has Alzheimer's, advanced dementia. Usually it'll be a husband will kill a wife because...
You mean a mercy killing.
It's called a mercy killing. It's a mercy killing. And that is a crime. Even secularly it is a crime. But usually the juries are very, very lenient. Say again?
Depends on the state.
Why? There's some states where...
Some states where it's okay.
Are you serious? A mercy killing?
It's like two where...
You can actually shoot somebody?
They've had cases go through. No, not necessarily shoot somebody.
No, I'm not talking about assisted suicide. I'm not talking about withdrawal of life support. I'm talking about actually shooting somebody. A mercy... I can't imagine any state would officially allow that. But okay. Be it as it may, but the common thing that the husbands say is, I could not stand to see her suffering.
Right, which is...
Now the question is, was she suffering or was I suffering seeing her that way? You see, it's not always clear. Now again, this is very complicated. It's not always clear, and I don't want to say for sure one way or the other, but it's not always clear how much an Alzheimer's patient is suffering. At least there are moments in which things are pleasant. They go back to their childhood. They remember their parents, or whatever it is. Now, there are other times where there's a lot of agitation. That is true also. But the problem is, when husbands are saying this idea, or wives for that matter, but usually for some reason it's the husband telling the wife, they're not really experiencing the suffering of the patient. it is their suffering that they're confusing with their, with, right? Now, with this abortion issue, it's going to be the same issue. The issue is, what would the mother want to do? Not, what does the father think is better for the family? Although, by definition, he might think that his wife would want to do what's best for the family. So, it's a confusing mental operation. Okay. Bottom line, with all, again, I apologize for all the digressions. I hope it's not too too confusing. But the bottom line is that so far, we have not come up with a halachic argument that would permit the destruction of an embryo for stem cells. The 40-day thing may not work, and the pikuach nefesh may not work, because the Shulchan Aruch says it's based on rodef, and rodef doesn't apply to use stem cells for a sick patient who might be 100 miles or 1,000 miles away.
Well, so, what's the baltashkus? No?
What's the baltashkus? To do what?
To leave the embryo.
Well, we'll talk about that, but once again, baltashkus doesn't allow you to commit an abortion. I mean, you can't commit an abortion because otherwise it'll go to waste. I mean, you know, that wouldn't be a justification to do something that would be an abortion. So let me mention now a third line of reasoning, which actually has been mekubal, it has been accepted by many, many poskim. And that is the following. You may recall that although Judaism is against abortion on demand, 100%, unless the mother's life is in danger, it is against abortion, but it is not against abortion for the same reason that the Catholic Church is against abortion. The Catholic Church is against abortion because they regard a fetus as a full-fledged life. They regard the fetus as a human being from conception, and any destruction of the fetus or the embryo is murder mamash. Jewish law does not accept it that way. Under Jewish law, if I kill a person, I could be put to death in the time of the temple. If I kill a fetus, I could not be put to death. Meaning, abortion is not based on murder. Abortion is not murder. Abortion is prohibited because it is the abrogation of a potential life. It is not, remember, as just as Rashi said, potential versus actual. So the predicate of abortion is not fetal personhood. It is fetal potential. In other words, abortion is based on, or the prohibition against abortion is based on potentiality, not on actuality.
So you could say it's the same strength as someone taking birth control.
Yeah, well, you're correct. That's also frustrating a potential, but once again, it's not yet, well, okay, there are going to be levels here. I mean, you could say sperm, egg. Once it's an embryo, the potential is so close to being realized that the halacha becomes stronger as you get it. But you are correct. Now, here is the argument. If the prohibition against the destruction of an embryo is not because it is life, but because it has the potential to become life, so listen to this argument. It is arguable that the prohibition arises only when the embryo is in the environment where, in the natural course of a pregnancy, it will come to fruition. In other words, it is already in the womb. Remember, we do not have yet an artificial womb. A petri dish can sustain, you can't grow a baby in a petri dish. What's going to happen in an IVF is, if you don't implant, or, you know, it could freeze it, but in the absence of freezing, if you don't implant within 14 days, the embryo just dissolves.
Then you're still preventing it.
No, but here's the point. The point is, something is called a potential when it is able, in the automatic course of events, to turn into a life. So, according to this idea, even if pre-40 days are forbidden, pre-40 days, we're going strict here, that's only after there is womb, uterine implantation. Until there is uterine implantation, it is not yet in the environment where it could come to fruition. Now, this is a psak that has been accepted, which would therefore authorize you to allow embryos to be donated for stem cell research on the grounds that the abortion laws do not apply to unimplanted embryos. This is not a pre-40 day and a post-40 day. This is a pre-implantation versus a
post-implantation. But it could be implanted. Aren't you
going to
freeze it?
You could, well, freezing is absolutely the best option. All I'm saying is that it is not an abortion.
But freezing is the best option, but if you have, I don't know how it works, but could you have more than a couple of embryos?
Well, yes, you can have, you know.
Not one shot, I'm saying. Is that possible?
Well, yeah, they could. Well, they'll implant whatever you want. I mean, they'll implant 2, 3, 4, 5. Octomom in California had 8 embryos. Now, most fertility clinics won't.
I'm saying when they.
Yep. No. So, again, let me remind you. What they do is they give the woman hormonal drugs that stimulate what's called superovulation, a lot of eggs, and they might extract from her at one shot. They might extract from her up to 10 or 15 eggs, in the hope that at least one of them will get fertilized. And if one or two get fertilized, no problem. But sometimes what happens is 10 of them get fertilized. And our problem is, what do you do with all 10? You know, let's say the woman could take 2, but what do you do with the other 8? So what I'm saying,
technically you could freeze them.
Yes, yes. So that's correct. That's correct.
Tons of money.
That's correct. That's correct.
No, I understand.
No. That is by far the best option. All I'm saying is halacha would permit the donation of spare embryos for stem cell research, because it would not be treated as an abortion, because until it is in the natural environment of which it comes to fruition, it is not yet considered to be a potential life. So this is where we would differ with the Catholic Church in this way. So halacha would validate stem cell retrieval from embryonic stem cells. Yeah.
I have more of a scientific question.
Yep.
Can stem cells only be taken from an embryo that's created through in vitro fertilization? Could they ever have an abortion where they could preserve the embryo?
100% correct. Stem cells can certainly be taken from an aborted fetus. But then it would be an abortion. That would be the difference. In other words, the point that we're talking about is embryonic stem cells from IVF embryos. And that halachically would be permitted. Stem cell retrieval through abortion of an implanted embryo would be forbidden. Anyway, it's much easier from an IVF.
But just for therapeutic uses, right?
Yeah, for therapeutic uses. Yeah, therapeutic uses. Yeah.
Like
more yavin
will be okay then?
Like
in the uterus?
So that's a tricky problem. It's in the uterus, but it's not implanted in the uterus. Yeah, so that's the question. The question is in the uterus, or implanted in the uterus? You'd have a problem. That would be a more of a close issue. That would be another machlokas, as it were.
You can also have a pregnancy within the
fallopian tube. Yes. But an ectopic pregnancy is a matter of danger to the mother's life. So absolutely, abortion is absolutely permitted for an ectopic pregnancy. And that makes a lot of sense, because the baby is not going to survive either. So that would be a clear case where abortion would be required, and the mother wouldn't even have the option of saying no, because what's the purpose? The baby is not going to survive that. So both are going to die if you don't do the abortion. Now, let me just mention, this idea of the unimplanted embryo is not subject to abortion is very, very relevant in another area of law, of halacha, and that is genetic testing. Let me give you another set of problems there. You know, maybe you've been involved in this already, there are certain genetic conditions that are uniquely associated with Jews, usually Ashkenazic Jews. For some reason, Sephardim have less of these genetic conditions. The most common and the most devastating is Tay-Sachs, right? Tay-Sachs is a real, real devastating childhood illness that so far really has a 100% mortality rate by 10 years old or even earlier. And it's not just mortality, but blindness and paralysis and all sorts of. It's like a childhood version of ALS, of Lou Gehrig's, but it's much quicker. And the way it works is, in order for a child to have this dreaded disease, both parents must be carriers of the gene. And if both parents are carriers of the gene, there is a 1 in 4 chance, 1 in 4 chance that a child will have the illness. If, however, only one parent is a carrier, then no child will be sick, although a child may a child may be a carrier, but he will not have the illness.
Before you get tested before.
Yeah, so they have now in the religious community an organization, Dor Yesharim, in which people can pre-test. The organization will notify you whether you're compatible. Right? Let's say, I want to go out with Sarah. So Sarah gets genetically tested and I get genetically tested. And if we both have the Tay-Sachs gene, I mean, it's kind of stupid. They don't tell you who has the gene, but obviously if they say, no, you're not compatible, you both have it. And they'll just say,
Tay-Sachs, right?
No. So it started 30 years ago, 40 years ago, just with Tay-Sachs. Mm-hmm. It now has many, many more. And some people are a little critical of it because now they're testing for things that are not, you know, Tay-Sachs is fatal and painful. Now they're testing for conditions that, you can live with them. I mean, people are considering now testing for, things like, they haven't done this yet, but things like, propensity to obesity or baldness.
Wow. Jewish
people? Yeah, people are talking about
this. What about, like, Down syndrome?
There is a way, yes. They're also testing for things that have long latency periods. This is a very difficult problem, such as, Parkinson's or Huntington's disease, Woody Guthrie. In other words, these are diseases that don't manifest themselves for 30, 40, or 50 years. So some people are actually critical of the whole genetic testing movement because you have to have faith. You have to have faith in God, meaning to say you want the perfect marriage. I want a marriage where there'll be no problem at all. Well, you have to... In fact, a woman wrote an article. She was not even Jewish. This was quite an amazing article. She said she went through all the genetic testing and she and her husband are not Jewish and they had a Tay-Sachs baby.
Well,
which is pretty unusual, actually.
But they are Jewish.
They're not Jewish and we didn't have the gene. It happens, right? It happens. The same way it mutated when it started, it can mutate even now. Okay. So, here is the question I want to raise with you. Now, let's go over this. Let's say you have a married couple. Again, I'm giving you hard and sad cases tonight. You have a married couple. They discover after they're married that they are both carriers of the Tay-Sachs gene.
They can get divorced.
Well, let's go over the options. And that means one out of four children they'll have. Now, that's only statistics. It may not be so, but that's the statistics. Will have this awful, debilitating childhood disease. And this thing happens, by the way. This is not hypothetical. I mean, there are people who don't get tested and they find out afterwards that they're both carriers. What should they do at this point? So let's list our choices. Option number one, get divorced. If there's a 1 in 4 chance, our children are going to have a serious, serious disease, not just birth defect, but a fatal disease. Let's get divorced and start over with somebody else. That's possible. But you do understand that if the couple has a loving relationship, a caring relationship, it would be very cavalier to just tell them, you got to get divorced. Okay, so we would not automatically encourage that. If they didn't get married yet, that's one thing. But let's say they've been married for 5 years. They love each other deeply. Option number two, permanent contraception. Permanent contraception.
Permanent?
Well, because... I'm mentioning options. I'm not saying... I'm going to analyze if they allowed or not. But, okay. Right? Meaning, let's not have kids because every pregnancy might be a Tay-Sachs. Well, number one, there are two problems with that. First of all, there is a mitzvah in the Torah, on the man at least, to be fruitful and multiply.
What about an IUD?
Well, what would the IUD do?
It's still not on the man.
No, but still, the man has a mitzvah to have children. So how can the man, if you have whatever the contraceptive method is, you're correct, it's not spilling seed, that's correct. But the man has a positive commandment to have children.
Yeah.
So IUD is not going to change that. So number one, there's a problem of pru or vu. And number two, I mean, there's a 3 out of 4 chance they'll have a healthy child. You're giving up all children because of this possibility. Okay, so that wouldn't be good either. Option number three, attempt pregnancy, And through amniocentesis, you can determine if the baby that's being carried is a Tay-Sachs baby. And if, God forbid, it's a Tay-Sachs baby, we could abort. Well, not so good. Not so good. Abortion is a very, very serious avera unless the mother's life is in danger. And according to most opinions, even if there's a significant genetic illness, you're not allowed to abort. Now, there is one exception. There is the Shita, I'm not sure if I mentioned it before, of Rabbi Eliezer Voldenberg. I mentioned him a few times. He was a great posek in Yerushalayim who specialized in medical halacha. He was the rabbi of the Shaarei Tzedek Hospital for many, many years. That's the Orthodox hospital in Jerusalem. And he took the position that you could abort a Tay-Sachs fetus up to the end of the second trimester, up to 6 months. But because he basically said that the pain of having this child and the pain that the child will go through is enough of a justification. But Rabbi Feinstein and the Rebbe and many other people said this is absolutely forbidden. And they even used language, God will have to forgive, I mean, they use very, very harsh language, God will have to forgive Rev Waldenberg for giving such a psak. So we would have to say amniocentesis is not good either. Now, but based on what we've discussed, there is a fourth option that is halakhically permissible. And that is, they would have intercourse through with contraception, let's say, an IUD, let's say, but then they would attempt pregnancies through IVF. And then they could do what is called pre-implantation genetic screening. And if it's true that the halakha of abortion does not kick in until implantation, so they would be permitted to screen the pre-implanted embryos for Tay-Sachs, and they would be allowed to destroy them and donate them to stem cell or whatever they could.
Check wallets in the uterus and they have to hang it out.
No, no, this would be IVF. This would be before they put it into the uterus. In other words, IVF, in vitro. Before, they could check it before they put it in. That's the thing. Once it's in, they wouldn't be allowed to...
Same.
Yep.
But you have to, like, extract it first and say it has to be in a petri dish?
No, no. Okay, the way an in vitro works is... they extract an egg.
Right, that's what I'm
they fertilize it in the petri dish.
Yeah.
And then they could analyze whether it's a Tay-Sachs embryo or not.
Oh.
Yeah. It hasn't been implanted back into the woman yet.
Does insurance cover that?
No, it's so expensive, I think.
It depends on the policy. You know, some does, some.
Like, wow.
In Israel, it covers. You know, Israel is very, very.
It's an elective procedure like that? Like it's.
Oh, you're talking about when there's not an infertility problem.
Right.
I don't know. I'd have to check. Yeah. You know, money is an issue here. It is very much the case. Now, let me mention that there's a fifth option. So I mentioned different options. I mentioned divorce, permanent contraception, abortion. Those three are not good. Pre-implantation genetic screening through an IVF would be permitted. There is a fifth option. And the fifth option is the option of the righteous. And not everybody can take this option. But it is the option of the tzaddik. And the option of the righteous is that we accept what God gives us. We will try to have a family. We will pray for rachamim. Jews are not always subject to statistics. Statistics are just statistics. And if Hashem gives us trials and challenges, we will accept those trials and challenges with love. Now that, which means we're not going to do any. We will have a family. And we will just go ahead. Now, some people might be critical of this, some people might call it irresponsible, but spiritually, every soul does have its mission in the world. And I will tell you that parents that have had Tay-Sachs children, and the children died, and somebody remarked to the parents, I've read stories, someone remarked to the parents very unthinkingly, you know, wouldn't it have been better if the child had never been born?
They would never say that.
I mean, you know, it'd be crazy. I don't know why somebody would say it, but somebody said it. And the parents said, no, absolutely not. So now I understand that the reason why I mentioned the other options is not everybody is able to live on that level. And therefore, halacha does accommodate the pre-implantation genetic screening. But in no way do I mean to suggest that, you know, that's bedafka the way that you should go. As we grow in emunah, as we grow in bitachon, we accept everything Hashem puts in our lives as a potential blessing. But once again, halacha is very, Hashem in his halacha is very compassionate, recognizing that at different stages in my life, in my wife's life, in my life, I might not be ready to live on that level. So the halacha does allow alternative ways of dealing with this particular issue. Okay? So this is called pre-implantation genetic screening, sometimes abbreviated PGS, or its non-kosher version is PIGS, pigs, but okay, but the PGS is what we call. And it's very useful for a lot of things. Now, people are using it, though, in improper ways. You can use it for sex selection, because you can see if an embryo is male or female.
Eye color,
possible, all sorts of things. And this already would not be proper. You don't start throwing away human embryos for trivial reasons. But even sex selection might be legitimate if there is a genetic illness that is linked to gender. A very good example is hemophilia. Mm-hmm. Hemophilia is that's bleeding without a clotting factor. A hemophiliac baby, a bris is very, very dangerous. A baby can die from a bris mila.
So wouldn't you just not do it at that age?
You actually don't do it at that age, but whatever it is, but whatever, they're special. So hemophilia is a condition that is linked to male. The female can be a carrier, but only the male gets the actual disease. So one would be permitted to do sex selection through pre-implantation genetic screening if there's a hemophilia strain that's running through. By the way, I think that used to be called the royal illness because there were so many, because of the interbreeding between Germany and England and France, all these royal houses were marrying into each other. And some of them had hemophilia, so it became very, very widespread in the royal families of England, Germany, and France.
Is it 100% genetic?
Oh, yeah. Hemophilia.
The parent has the child, has it?
Well, it doesn't mean every child will have it, but every child that has it is getting it from a gene passed down by the parents.
They both have to be carriers?
No, I don't think so. No,
just one.
No, just
what
one.
Is it
just
exactly
one.
Like if you got a cut, you can't kind of.
It means your blood does not clot. Clot is how the blood stops bleeding.
So how do they deal? How do people survive with it?
They survive, but it's very difficult. Every playground scrape. Is a life-threatening procedure. The kids have to be very, 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 very careful.
They're medicated with clotting factors.
They're medicated. There's clotting factors, but that also has very bad side effects. Yeah. It's a difficult illness. I mean, I know. I mean, a member of my show, and then Silver Spring was a hemophiliac, and Baruch Hashem, now he's in his 40s, and he has children. He survived.
You're from Silver Spring?
Yeah, I'm Silver Spring.
I'm from Vienna, Virginia.
Oh, okay. We're neighbors. Okay. Relatively speaking, yeah. So people do survive. I mean, people, Baruch Hashem, many people do survive, but it's a very harrowing, especially childhood. Once you're an adult, adults tend not to get scratched up so much. Mm-hmm. But for children, it's very, very difficult. Children in playgrounds and like that.
Is there any basis for sex selection if, someone's trying to fulfill the Torah commandment?
I understand. That I think that would be discouraged. Now, let me point out, though, the following. If we're talking about sex selection and destroying the other embryos, that's one thing. But if we're talking about, we have a lot of embryos, and which one should we freeze for later, and which one should we use now, you can certainly select the other one now, because you're not destroying. But where I think we would be against it is to destroy something just for sex purposes. Now, in China, this is a very big deal. And we're not just dealing with abortion, we're dealing with infanticide. China, for many, many years, because of its population growth, had a one-child rule. You only were allowed to have one child. I think now they changed it to two children. I think somebody here told me that.
Depends on where you are.
Yeah, but now, in the Chinese countryside especially, where a lot of them are kind of, they have the old traditions, that you have to have a boy. So if the first child was a girl, they would routinely kill her. And I don't mean abortion. I'm talking about she was born. They would leave her to die. And this is even modern times. This is very, very common. And I just read a story about a woman who somehow gave birth to six babies. And she said she did not take fertility drugs, which is against the law in China. She just had six babies. And the you know, the government told her, choose the two, and you know, we have to kill the other four next week. You know, so you're given 1 week to decide. They told her, you know, and that's how it is. It's very, very ruthless in that way. Alrighty, so you have a good week and enjoy the rain, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, okay.